The white fleck was a piece of domestic soap, with a wet lacework of bubbles still frothing around it. There were damp marks on the rocks that the sizzling sun had not yet dried, and in the mud at the water's edge, amongst all the thousand of hoof marks, was a print. A strange, half-human print, like that of a giant bird. The big toes, deeply divided from the rest of the foot, split halfway back to the heel. And I knew that Timothy McGeeber was watching me over the sights of an automatic weapon. My skin prickled as from the stings of the myriad insects of fear. They crawled over my body and along the strings of my nerves. Slowly I walked back to Lauren. The cigar was in his mouth, and he struck a match as I approached. It flared in a puff of blue nitrous smoke in his cupped hands, and he bowed over it. "Lo," I said softly, "don't do anything suddenly. Behave as naturally as you can. They're here, right here, watching us." He puffed four times and then waved the match to extinguish it. And he looked around naturally. "Where?" he asked. "I don't know, but they're very close. We must show ourselves here until Mac is ready." "Tell the troopers," Lowe said. The troopers were recapping the jerry cans, and as they moved back past us, I stopped them. "Go very gently. Do not run. Do not look behind you. The evil ones are here. Go to the inspector. Tell him to start the engines, and when we hear them, we will come running." They nodded expressionlessly, understanding immediately, and I knew then why these were famed as the finest native troops in Africa. They went calmly up the bank, leaning away from the weight of the jerry cans. "I feel like one of those little mechanical ducks in a shooting gallery," I said, and tried to smile. But it hung all crookedly on my face. "What are they waiting for?" I asked. "Ah, they probably didn't have time to set it up properly." Lorden laughed. "A very good effort. It rang convincingly. They'll be moving into position now. And then they'll wait until we're all together in a bunch and not spread out like this. God, I wish I knew where they are, where to expect it to come from." "What tipped you?" Lorden asked. Anything to keep this conversation flowing naturally. "Piece of soap and wet footprints on the rocks. They were bathing when we heard us coming." Lorden tapped ash from his cigar and glanced at the rocks, seeing the soap. And then his eyes flicked back to me. Above the bank we heard the starters whirring loudly in the silence, and then the engines running steadily. One, two, and the third one. Lorden ground the fresh cigar into the mud at the edge of the pool and then turned to me. He let his hand fall onto my shoulder. "All the way, partner?" he asked. "All the way, Lo." And we whirled together and went for the path up the bank, unslinging the rifles as we ran. I felt a lift of relief. The waiting was over. It had begun. I had the strange sensation of not moving, of marking time rather than running. The climb up the bank seemed endless. My feet dragged leadenly, and a hot, hushed silence persisted in which the engines of the Land Rovers seemed muted, but our footsteps pounded like stampeding hooves. We came out on top of the bank. Sergeant Nabuka was at the wheel of our vehicle, swinging in towards us, slowing for the pickup. The other two Land Rovers were backing up, ready to cover us, turning for the path, with the gunners traversing the heavy machine guns. "Jump!" shouted MacDonald. "Let's hit out!" I leapt for the side of the Land Rover, and Lorden piled in beside me. "Go!" he snapped urgently at the sergeant. The engine roared, and we surged forward. From the moment when we started to run to the moment we boarded the speeding vehicle, perhaps 6 seconds had elapsed. It had all gone very quickly, and I scrambled onto my knees, pushing the automatic rifle forward to cover one flank. In that instant, they opened on us. The air around me was torn by the sound of 1,000 bullwhips, while the gunfire sounded like a stick dragged swiftly across a corrugated iron fence. MacDonald's vehicle was leading us out, back along our tracks. It was drawing fire also. I saw the gunner hit, his head snapping backwards as though from a heavy punch, and his hat flying from his head. He collapsed over the seat, his untended weapon spiraling idly on its mounting. They were below the river bank, lining it, hidden in the reeds and scrub there. I saw the muzzle flashes, glinting like swords. I let off a burst, swinging on them, but with the Land Rover bucking I was low. Dust flew in a line below the bank, as though her whiplash had churned the dust. I corrected my aim and fired, the weapon shuddering in my hands. Seeing the reeds shake and tremble as my bullets raked them, someone screamed, a thin, passionless sound, and my weapon clicked empty. I snatched for a fresh magazine, looking ahead to estimate how much longer we must receive fire. MacDonald was just entering the forest. There were big trees on either side of the path, indicating the passage. I saw the loose earth in the path, ahead of MacDonald, swept neatly, and I knew then why they had held their fire until it served to drive us into the trap. I opened my mouth to scream a warning, but it was lost in the continuous clamor of gunfire and engine roar. MacDonald hit the landmines they'd laid for us across our old tracks, and the detonation was a burst of bright white light that seared the retina of the eye. The concussion slammed painfully into my eardrums, and MacDonald's Land Rover reared like a wounded lion. Its front end was smashed in, one of the wheels spinning lazily through the air. It toppled backwards, crushing the occupants beneath it. The second Land Rover drove into it at 30 miles an hour. There was a rending, screeching sound of metal as the two came together. "Look out!" shouted Lorin, and the sergeant swung the wheel violently to avoid colliding with the mass of wrecked vehicles. Our Land Rover hung over on two wheels and then flopped over on its side. We were thrown out onto the rocky earth. There was a silence that lasted for 3 or 4 seconds. A stunned silence. Even the enemy frozen by the suddenness of the havoc they had created. We were perhaps 50 yards from the riverbed where Timothy's men lay. The intervening ground was sparsely studded with fever trees. These, and the bodies of the vehicles, gave us little cover. I'd lost my rifle, and as I groped for it, I found Hai huddled next to me. I had one glimpse of his terrified face as I crawled towards Lurin. "Are you all right?" For answer, he pointed. "Look." 20 feet away, Alistair MacDonald lay on his back, with the full weight of the Land Rover lying across his pelvis. He was pushing at the mass of metal with weak, fluttering hands. He moaned then softly. I stood up to go to him, and at that moment the guns opened again, flailing us, rattling and clanging against the Land Rovers, lashing billows of dust and storms, of stone fragments, ricocheting with the sound of tearing silk, and Lurin dragged me down. I was aware of movement beside me, and as I turned towards it, little Hai wailed softly like a restless baby. I put out my hand to calm him, but my touch galvanized him. He jumped to his feet, his dark amber eyes ablaze with terror, and he ran. "Wait, wait, little brother," I shouted, and I scrambled up to follow him. Lurin grabbed and held me, and I watched as Hai ran out into that hell storm. He drew all their fire immediately. They hunted him, hosing bullets at him. He ran like a rabbit caught in a car's headlights, making no attempt to hide. I struggled in Lurin's grip. "No," I shouted. "Leave him! No, no!" And they hit him, knocking him down so that he rolled across the stony earth like a small brown ball. He came up on his feet again, still running, but his left arm was shot away above the elbow, holding only by a tatter of wet flesh, and it bounced loosely against his flank. They hit him again, squarely this time between the shoulder blades, and he went down hard and skidded on his face. He lay very still and small in the harsh white sunlight. I was quiet in Loren's glip, while around me the surviving troopers crawled into position to return the enemy fire. Loren rolled away from me, lying prone, and fired a burst around the tailboard of the overturned Land Rover. The storm of bullets returned to sweep over us, and MacDonald was still moaning. Nobody could reach him across that bullet-swept space. I knelt on the hard earth, staring at Hai's frail little body, and I felt the hot winds of my rage blow through my soul. They came from deep and far, crescendoed and overwhelmed my reason. I jumped up and ran to the mined Land Rover. I tore the pin from the mounting and hefted the heavy machine gun out of its seating. Then I threw four loops of the cartridge belt over my shoulders, draping myself with death as though it were a Hawaiian lei. And then, with the gun on my hip, I went after them, running down towards the riverbed, straight at the center of their line. I heard myself screaming, and the violent disruption of the air around me as shot passed close, buffeted my ears and fanned my face with a hot, dry wind. I ran, screaming, and the gun shook my body as though it were a giant fist. The spent cartridge cases spewed from the breech in a glittering stream, ringing like silver bells as they bounced off the stony earth. I saw the lip of the bank dissolve in spurting, swirling clouds of dust as I traversed it. Saw one of them hit and flung backwards. Their fire was shriveling. I saw movements in the reeds as they ran. One of them leapt to his feet and fired a burst. Beside me, slabs of white bark exploded from the trunk of a fever tree, and I swiveled the gun onto him. He was in camouflage battle dress, a pudding basin helmet of steel on his head, and he crouched over his weapon. The muzzle winked its hot red eye at me, and I wondered that it could miss me at such a close range. One of my bullets caught him in the mouth, spinning his helmet away, and the contents of his skull blew out of the back of his head in a pink cloud. He dropped below the bank. "Follow him! Cover him!" I heard Loren yelling somewhere behind me. But I didn't care. I reached the bank of the river and looked down into the dry bed. They were running, panicky, for the far bank, and I turned the gun on them, watching as they fell, with the white sand dancing in sudden soft fountains among them. I was still screaming. The last loop of cartridges flipped off my shoulder and fed into the hungry breech of my weapon. The gun went dead and useless in my hands, and I hurled it after them. Rage and sorrow had driven me far beyond the boundaries of reason and fear. I stood unarmed and unafraid, and from the far bank, Timothy McGeeber turned back towards me. He had a pistol in his right fist, and he aimed at me. I felt the passage of the bullet close beside my head. "Murderer!" I screamed, and he fired again, twice. It was as though the angels of death had draped their wings around me, shielding me, for I didn't even hear the bullets. I saw him glaring at me, those terrible smoky eyes, the great cannonball head like that of some wounded beast at bay. And then, suddenly, Loren was beside me. He threw up his rifle and snapped a shot at Timothy. I think Loren may have nicked him, for I saw him wince and stagger slightly, but then he was gone into the thick scrub that covered the high ground on the far bank. The police troopers went past us, moving forward in line of skirmishers down the bank and across the riverbed where the dead men lay. They fired a few rounds into the bush, and then Loren called them back. Loren turned to stare at me with a look of disbelief. "They didn't touch you," he said with wonder. "Not a single bullet. My God, Ben, my God." He shook his head. "You frightened me, you crazy bastard. You frightened the hell out of me." He put his arm around my shoulder and led me back to the vehicles. MacDonald was still moaning softly. We lifted the side of the Land Rover, Lurin and I between us. MacDonald screamed as the troopers drew him out from under the vehicle. His legs were twisted at an odd angle, and his face was very pale, his tan a dirty brown over it, and little beads of sweat dewed his upper lip. I left Lurin to administer morphine and try to splint the badly shattered bone, and I went across to where Hai lay. The entry hole was a blue-black pucker in the center of his back. There was no bleeding from it, and yet he lay in a puddle of thick, gelatinous blood, and I knew what hideous damage the exit of the bullet from his chest must have caused. I didn't turn him over. I couldn't bring myself to do it. But his head was twisted sideways, and I squatted beside him. With my fingertips, I closed the lids over those staring Chinese eyes. "Go in peace, little brother," I whispered. "Come on, Ben. They'll be back. We must hurry," Loudon called. Two of our troopers were dead, and the sergeant rolled them in their blankets. "The bushman also," I told him. He hesitated, but then he saw my expression and went quickly. We rolled the third vehicle back onto its wheels, and while the troopers lifted our dead and wounded aboard, Lorden and I checked it out. Two of the tires were shot through, the petrol tank was riddled, the steering box was severed by a bullet, and another had shattered the engine sump cover. Oil poured from it, stinking in the heat. Quickly, Lauren placed the sergeant and the three remaining troopers in a defensive perimeter amongst the fever trees, and we pushed the crippled Land Rover into the lee of the wrecked vehicles, giving ourselves some cover to work behind. There was a toolbox in MacDonald's Land Rover. We changed the wheels as quickly as a pair of Grand Prix mechanics, cannibalizing from the wrecks. As we tightened the last wheel, the sniping began. It was long range from the far ridge a quarter of a mile away. They'd learnt their lesson well and kept a respectful distance now. Our troopers answered, blazing away with the two heavy machine guns to discourage them further. In the middle of a firefight, Lorden and I worked greasy to the elbows. Smearing skin from knuckles on sharp steel in our haste, burning blisters into our skin on the red-hot manifold and exhaust system. We pulled the sump cover off the capsized Land Rover and lay on our backs with hot oil dripping onto our faces as we bolted it back onto our vehicle. The gasket was torn. It would leak, but it would hold oil long enough to get us clear. Lauren changed the steering box while I found a cake of soap in my pack and plugged the bullet holes in the fuel tank. As we worked, I blessed the Chinese artisans who'd manufactured those shoddy weapons on the far ridge with their limited range and accuracy. We refueled and replaced the engine oil, standing by necessity, fully exposed to the marksmen on the hill, forcing ourselves to work methodically and trying to shut out from our ears the terrifying sound of a passing shot. Lauren jumped into the driver's seat and pressed the starter. It whirled dismally on and on, and I closed my eyes tight and prayed. Lauren released the starter button, and in the silence I heard him swearing with bitter vehemence. He tried again. The battery was weakening now, and the whirring of the engine slowed and faltered. A stray bullet smashed the windscreen, spraying us with glittering grass fragments. Lauren was still swearing. In despair, I glanced at the setting sun. Only half an hour or so of daylight left. In the darkness, the hyenas would come down from the ridge. As though they'd read my thoughts, the fire from up there intensified. I heard a bullet whine off the metal of the Land Rover. Lurin jumped out of the driver's seat and opened the bonnet again. As he worked, I shouted across to Nakabua. "Why aren't you firing, Sergeant? You're letting them have target practice. Keep the heads down, damn it." "The ammunition is almost finished, sir," he called back. And a coldness closed about my guts. No ammunition, and darkness coming on fast. Lurin slammed the bonnet closed and ducked back into the driver's seat. He looked at me through the shattered windscreen. "Say another prayer, Ben. The last one was no damn good." And he pressed the starter. It wheezed wearily, but the engine wouldn't turn. "We've had it, Ben," Lurin told me. "Both the other batteries are kaput." "Sergeant, all of you, shove," I shouted. "Come on, help me." They ran to me at the rear of the Land Rover. "Try her in second," I shouted at Lurin, and a burst of bullets kicked around my legs, stinging them with fragments of stone. We threw our combined weight on the Land Rover, and it bumped over rough ground back towards the river. "Now!" I shouted at Lurin. The Land Rover juddered and slowed, and we hurled ourselves against it, keeping it moving against compression. It fired once. "Keep going," I gasped. And abruptly the engine roared into life, and we howled with triumph. "Climb on," Lurin yelled, and swung the Land Rover back towards the trail. But I ran beside him. "Matches!" "What?" "Give me your matches, damn you!" I snatched them from his hand and ran to the tangled wreckage. Gasoline was dribbling from one of the ruptured tanks, and I flicked a match at it. The sucking, roaring torrent of flame licked across my face, singeing my eyelashes away. And I turned and ran after the Land Rover, scrambling in over the tailboard, falling face forward onto the pile of dead and wounded men in the back. Lurin smashed a new route through a belt of scrub thorn, avoiding the mine trail, and then angled back to pick it up further out. The firing from the ridge died away as the forest blanketed us. I watched the column of black, sooty smoke climbing up into the flushed evening sky, pleased that I'd denied them the spoils of victory. And suddenly I found myself shaking like a man in high fever. Icy waves of shock and reaction engulfed me. "You all right, Ben?" Lurin called to me. "Yes, yes, I'm fine," I answered, and looked down at the pathetic blanket-wrapped bundles at my feet.